welcome to Ed History 101. I am your lead researcher and main storyteller, Jennifer. Being patient and kind is my husband,
Paul. Hi.
So unlike other classes you may have taken, this one's slightly different. It is Friday night. Paul and I are enjoying a lovely bottle of Dreaming Tree every day and talking through the history of education because we are two wild and crazy people, guys, gals.
Well, we're not two wild and crazy guys or
this
gals.
Is true.
So,
what was the shtick? It was two wild and crazy guys, right?
Yes, that was the shtick.
Well, that doesn't work for us, and thereby we have just dated ourselves. We're old enough to remember Saturday Night Live
with Steve Martin.
With Steve Martin,
you're not.
No, I'm not.
Neither am I, but sort of.
Sort of. It's in our cultural essence. So, some quick housekeeping about this podcast. I love education and history and storytelling, Paul.
I like storytelling.
Yeah. And I was a good student. And
I was not.
Yeah. So one of the key differences in our school experiences lie in second grade. And Paul, what was second grade like for you?
It was awful.
Why?
Because my teacher was no fun. And that's putting it mildly. She had a way about her that made everyone miserable.
That sounds like it was not a good year.
Was not fun.
So one of the things that Paul and I discovered when we were talking is that, as you know, old married couples are wont to do, that second grade for me was a year when I wanted to impress my teacher. I wanted to be the very best of her students, and Paul just kind of wanted to get through second grade.
Yes.
And then get through third grade.
And then get through the rest of it.
And so forth and so on. So when we were talking, we sat down and brainstormed a list of a bunch of stuff that Paul hated about school.
I didn't hate all of it.
Well, we came up with things like bells and exams and early mornings and school districts and a bunch of stuff that made school less than a pleasant experience.
Perfect.
So, one of the things that we discovered is that school is a very different experience depending on your background, your ethnicity, your gender, your race. A whole lot of things kind of factor into the school experience. So in this podcast, we're going to be using Paul kind of as our organizing center.
Woohoo! It's all about me.
It's going to be all about Paul and the things that Paul likes or doesn't like. And you can find out more about each topic on our podcast or on our website. It's www.edhistory101.com. I will list resources. I will list the answer to the pop quiz. Surprise!
Yay!
Paul's going to get at the end. And then some more information. Okay, since we're going to use you as the organizing focus, we have to kind of establish what your experience.
I prefer the term central focus.
Speaking it all about you, the central focus. Okay.
It's nothing to do with education, has everything to do with me.
Everything to do with you. So we're going to make you the central focus for the podcast.
Thank you.
So you are a white male of European descent.
Yes.
Okay. So in 1640, when the first laws around school were first passed, the experience of boys of white male descent would have been very different than girls of European descent. They also weren't very different than African American or enslaved children. There will come a time in our country when it will be illegal for slaves to learn how to read. And the history of Black Americans around education is a fantastic and incredible one that deserves its own podcast. Likewise, there's the history of Asian and Mexican and South American Americans, because not all early Americans were European. There were, you know, a variety of people here at the time. In addition, there's also the different experience of indigenous children. And so Native American or indigenous children, it was highly dependent upon the tribe you were born into. So some tribes did communal child rearing, where all kids would spend all day together, and it was kind of like school. They would learn skills and stories and communication traditions. So the actually experiences of indigenous children offer us the first example of compulsory education in America. Would you like to hear how?
I would love to.
That's what makes you such a great listener. So here's how it happened. So the first, what was happening when the Europeans came over, they were coming over for religious reasons. So religion plays a huge role in early education. It was very much a part of pretty much everything that happened related to schooling. And there were Native American families who would give their children to some of the settlements, and there were settlements that would take Native American children from their families. They weren't exactly slaves, but they weren't allowed to go home. And when these children were kidnapped, their spiritual well-being became the responsibility of the settlement or the people who had kidnapped them. So in 1656, there was a Virginia statute, and the statute was called On the Education of Indian Children Held Hostage. Yeah.
Wow.
Not very kind. But it appears this is the first time that adults in the form of the state, so they passed a statute, adults did, saying these individual group of children on American soil have to receive a particular education. And that education was learning how to read the scripture. So that seems to be the first time where adults said, you group of children will learn this particular thing in this particular way. However, for you, being a 6 or 5 year old boy of European descent, your experience was very, very, very different. Because for you, education was a whenever, wherever, however kind of thing. So really, the whole reason that you would have gotten an education in the 1640s in Massachusetts Bay Colony was to save your eternal soul. That was awesome. The gist. Yeah. That and to make sure you were a productive adult.
Well.
You know.
Both of those things are fairly important.
Yes,
to the 1640.
Whatever. Yes, to the Puritans. So they were basically preparing you for adulthood or for what came next. And the job of your education was your parents' job. It was their responsibility. But don't worry. Don't worry, Paul. I know you were worried.
I was very worried.
I could tell. I saw it on your face. If your parents couldn't do their job, the colony had your back as a little person. They were looking out for you.
Awesome.
Yes. 1647. The colonies passed a law that said if there are more than 100 homes, you have to build a grammar school. And if there's only 50 homes, you have to hire a teacher. And the purpose of this teacher was to make sure you could read because of the old deluder Satan. Say that 3 times fast. Yes.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah. So they passed a law called the Old Deluder Satan Law. And I have a very hard time putting the right emphasis on the right syllables in that. Because it's the old deluder Satan, because Satan's sneaky. And one of his tricks...
And he's old.
He's old. That's an important
point.
He's
old and sneaky.
Which means he's trying to trick you. And one of his tricks is that he would keep people from reading the scripture.
See?
Yes. So illiteracy was a trick of Satan. So the town was like, we won't let Satan fool us. We're going to make sure everyone can read their scripture. So the town was looking out for your immortal soul. That was where, yeah, that's where the original schools came from. So the parents had to make sure you could read. The church and the town wanted to make sure you could read your scripture. So everyone was looking out for you.
Well, ish.
Ish, yeah. Looking out-ish for you. So basically being literate meant you could sign your name. And you had a basic understanding of the
scripture.
Scripture and law and newspapers and things like that. If your parents were wealthy... You may have had a tutor imported just for you.
Ooh, that would be sweet.
Yeah. So it would just be you and a couple of your friends. Just your boyfriends. None of your girlfriends. Because girlfriends are, you know.
Yeah, they're not.
No.
It's all about me.
Exactly. You may have gone to what was called a dame school. D-A-M-E, a dame school. And this is where a person we brought in to teach a group of children to read. And dame schools were generally not for the wealthy, who would have tutors, not for the poor, because they were learning a trade. You know, they would learn just the bare basics to read the scripture. But the kind of the kids sort of in the middle, like tradespeople's.
The middle class.
As it were. So if you were really poor, you worked when your parents needed you to work, and you went to church when or school whenever you could, and if you were in the middle, a grammar school or a dame school would fill in the gaps. So education back then was making sure you were ready to be an adult and that your soul would be saved.
Well, they failed, because I'm still not ready to be an adult. That's beside the point.
That's beside the point. So this is kind of the system that was in place until the Revolution. Along comes the Revolution and the notorious T.J., Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson got a bug in his head that America couldn't be America if there wasn't some sort of formal education. And so his idea, this is like the 70s, he tried a lot to get this to pass, and it just kept getting turned down. Like he tried 3 times to get this law passed, and it was called For the More General Diffusion of Knowledge.
Wow.
Yeah, very fancy. So,
yeah.
I like the idea of diffusion of knowledge.
I like the idea of naming laws.
Yeah, with like these big fancy names.
Yeah. Now we have like HB 214. Who cares?
Well, I think we tried the Every Child Left Behind, but it doesn't have quite the same ring as For the More General Diffusion of Knowledge. Yeah,
we should really get on that.
Get back to the oratorial kind of thing. Yeah. So Thomas Jefferson's idea was if you take all these kids, you put them in a school, you could, quote, separate the geniuses from the rubbish. Yeah. And so there was a lot of resistance. Americans were saying, basically, we got this figured out. We don't need formal education. We've got to figure it out.
We don't need no education.
Exactly. Well, early 1700s, Pink Floyd there. So farmers are like, look, I need my kid to farm. I don't need to put him in school. Thomas Jefferson, whatever.
You don't need to read to farm.
Exactly. So Thomas Jefferson tried 3 times. It didn't work. So he went off and started a college. Basically said, forget this. I'm going to go start a college.
I'm going to educate white boys on my own.
Exactly. And I know you're deeply worried about white girls. I know you're worried.
No, it's all about me, but I was a little worried about it, too.
There was a dude, Benjamin Rush. And what Benjamin Rush said, and Benjamin Rush had a lot to say about the education of girls. And one of the things he said is that, quote, they should be compelled to engage in a peculiar mode of education. And he thought very long and hard, pages and pages and pages, about how girls should be educated. So girls should be prepared to raise their children and teach their sons about liberty and government. Yes. None of that using
it. They shouldn't worry about participating in liberty and government.
But
just teach your boys. Yeah. Just the boy children.
They should read and write English so that others might read her words were her husband have need of her assistance.
And she doesn't have words of her own.
No.
Just
her husband.
His words.
And she should learn her numbers just in case she marries a bookkeeper and he dies.
Because that was a very real possibility.
Yes. There were so many single bookkeepers.
In the 1700s.
Just a plethora of single bookkeepers. So she should also learn geography and chronology so she can be a good companion to her husband. Yes. And there's pages and pages. Did I say that? Pages and pages of stuff.
Nice.
My personal favorite thing in his list of things that women's peculiar education needs is that women should learn to sing because, and I quote, the distress and vexation of a husband, the noise of a nursery, and even the sorrows that will sometime intrude into her own bosom may be relieved by a song. In case you vex me, I can sing. Well,
and we don't use the word vexation enough.
And I don't think we often use the word bosom enough.
Yeah, but I think vexation...
Get more mileage out of vexation.
We should work on bringing that back.
I think you're right. And of course, you had to read the Bible.
Well.
Yeah. So these guys...
So at least women had a soul.
That is. Hey.
They just didn't have thoughts in their head.
Exactly.
That were their own.
Well, yes, we were holding them for the sons.
Yes. And the husbands. It's reasonable.
So are you again... So the theme here is that there's all these people, well, men, thinking about what education should look like. There's a lot of talk about what American education could be. A lot of ideas.
Isn't that what we do? This country's founded on?
Ideas?
A lot of talk about stuff that we should do.
Yes. So
my life.
One guy started to put things into actual practice. He kind of snuck up compulsory education on everybody. And this guy killed the letter U.
Wow.
Yeah.
We still have it, so we didn't kill it.
We moved it around. Noah Webster. Basically what Noah Webster said. Yeah.
Color. Honor.
Honor. Color.
Words
honor.
Like that.
Yeah, exactly. So what basically Noah Webster said is that if we're going to be our own country, we should have our own language.
Yeah. We can't be like the Canadians and the English.
Yeah, I don't even think there was a Canada then.
Yeah, whatever.
See,
I wasn't good in school, so I have an excuse.
So Noah Webster inadvertently compelled people to shift how they think about words, how they spell. So we have these guys germinating ideas that there should be a common... principles.
Like a core?
Like a core, like a common core of ideas around American education.
You know, I think we just mixed that thought right now because you might offend people.
Let's not go any further with common core.
I'll just let that joke die.
Yeah, so while Webster was saying, okay, we have all these ideas. Here's what we're going to do, though. We're going to get educated. We're going to talk a common language. And of course, they were talking about white men because,
Right.
Wealthy white men, I should say. Because the blacksmith's son has to go.
They're the ones that matter.
Exactly. So we're about early 1800s now. And what has happened is a lot of seed planting. A lot of ideas around we need to have an education. It should be available to everybody. So these seeds are starting to be planted. But
men are planting their seeds?
There's a lot of ideas across the country around an education.
Family show? We can't...
So what emerges is like this whole hodgepodge. There were pauper schools. There were Sunday schools. There were private schools. There was this system, but it was completely disjointed, completely unrelated. And then the 1840s. Immigrants.
Immigrants.
Along came the immigrants. The
immigrants.
Which I think we learned some of your people started to come over in the 1840s.
No, my people were later.
Okay. So.
Well, my actual people were later. I'm sure some of the people that lived in the neighborhood of my people were coming over in the.
So in the 1840s. So the idea around this time is that there was a huge wave of immigrants coming in from Europe. And this idea of public school started to be born. So if you were a six-year-old, let's stay with six, in the 1840s, you would start to go this thing called a common school. And what it was funded by local property taxes. So it was available to all of the white students who lived in the community, and it charged no tuition. So the community started to say, we've got all these people coming in. We've got to make sure everyone is literate. So all the seeds were planted. Now they're starting to take root and grow into this idea of common schools. So if you were a five-year-old in Massachusetts in 1840, so we're now talking 200 years after the indigenous children who were kidnapped were forced to read scripture, 200 years after your village was forced to build a school as a check and balance for your immortal soul. They probably
didn't do.
And rumor has it the statute said the town would be billed, but I'm not sure if anyone actually ever paid it, because they kept, every couple of years they would rewrite the law.
Yeah, we really should get a school.
We'll try again next year. So all of these things were kind of happening. So school really wasn't yet a concept, but then along came a superhero.
A school superhero. I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, his name is Horace Mann.
That's not a superhero name.
That's totally a superhero name.
It's not. That's a supervillain name.
I suppose he's a villain or a hero, depending on your perspective. But anyways, Horace Mann got this idea. Like Thomas Jefferson, he believed there had to be a common education for all of the people. And so he rode around, and he looked at all the schools that were currently happening. He looked at this hodgepodge system, and he said, "You're not going to believe how terrible this school is and how terrible that school is." And he gave speeches, and he orated, and he had bees in his bonnet, which I think is a great phrase, but probably won't work for
a dude who's probably not wearing a bonnet.
Scorpions in his stovepipe.
Yeah, it doesn't work so good.
So he had a lot. Am I communicating efficiently that Horace Mann had a lot of energy and fire around this idea?
He apparently really wanted it.
Yeah, so he was like a one man.
Well, we're still talking about him. So
yeah.
He must have been.
He was quite the thing. So he almost single-handedly, he had some help, but he almost single-handedly, is what you're saying we've kind of talked too much about Horace Mann?
No.
Oh.
No, but he must be important.
We could spend all day talking about Horace Mann, because Horace Mann really was.
I don't think all day is a good idea, because people will get bored.
Probably not. So his idea was, we build these schools, these common schools, and in these common schools, everyone, including immigrants, will receive an education in Christian morality and democratic patriotism.
Wow.
So Jefferson's ideas.
So, but boys, right?
Well, there is some evidence these were open to girls, too.
Oh.
And immigrants. So.
White immigrants.
No, well, immigrants. And I suspect at this time, if you were a voluntary immigrant, if you were not an enslaved person, you probably would be educated by your own community. So most likely just white children. But Horace tried to compel communities to open schools so that the new immigrants coming in could receive this education. And he was so persuasive and so fiery that between 1890 and 1920, they opened up on average one school per day.
So he is a superhero.
He is a superhero. Yeah. So he kind of pushed out the idea of hodgepodge schools and made school a thing. So by time the Civil War came around, schooling was starting to be something that children would do, that it would be expected children would go to the common school. Not every child every single day, but that would be something that they would do. So we're starting to build the infrastructure of the modern public school. If you were a white child living on the East Coast, For example, if you were a Native American child living out west, you may have been compelled to attend a mission school, a school opened by missionaries. If you were enslaved in the southern states, this is a point at which literacy was illegal, that actually learning how to read could be punishable by death. But that is not to say that all slaves remained illiterate. Some slaves learned how to read, and one of the common strategies that is talked about in some of the books is that children on a slave, on a plantation, slave children on a plantation, would have a class where supposedly they were sewing. But underneath their sewing, they would have access to books and primers where they would learn their alphabet. So we're coming up on the Civil War, but it's a little bit before the Civil War, about 1853. For the first time, Massachusetts passed the very first compulsory education law, 1853. And the law said, if you do not go to school, your parents will be fined or the town will be fined. So school started to be this thing where children in Massachusetts would go to. But it wasn't necessarily open to all children. These schools were poorly managed, poorly resourced. But for children of color, free children of color, their schools were even worse, even poorly resourced and poorly financed. And one girl's father took her case all the way to the state legislator and tried to get her enrolled in a school that was better resourced. And one of the town leaders said, quote, "For children of color, their peculiar physical, mental, and moral structure requires an educational treatment different from that of white children."
So we really liked that word peculiar back then.
Yeah, it really seems to be this all-purpose kind of word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the case went all the way to the Massachusetts legislation, and they passed the very first desegregation law. So 1853, Massachusetts said all white kids need to go to school. 1855, those schools need to be open to all children. And actually, New York State was the second state to pass a compulsory education law. I think they passed theirs like a year later. And the state that waited the longest was Mississippi. They didn't pass it until 1918. So
they were taking their time.
Taking their time.
Making sure.
And Massachusetts.
They understood everything that was involved.
Yeah. But Mississippi had some stuff to work out. Because they passed compulsory education.
I like the use of the word had.
They probably still have some things to work out. In 1956, Mississippi repealed compulsory education.
Because.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, as you probably noticed, is about the time of national desegregation laws and civil rights. And Mississippi actually didn't fix that until 1972.
Because, you know, they wanted to make sure they had all the facts.
Yeah. Yeah. So between 1853...
They came back from subcommittee. They made sure everything was...
Took a little while. Signed in triplicate.
Yeah.
They got it all straightened out. So between 1853 and 1918, all states came on board in terms of compulsory education. Schools started to create things called truant officers, whose job it was to find children who were not in school and then punish them. You know what the punishment was?
More school.
More school.
That's the perfect punishment.
It makes perfect sense.
Oh, you don't like it here? Stay some more.
So sometimes parents were fined, but sometimes laws were passed and they were utterly ignored. Like in Montana. Like Montana had a law that said kids had to go to school, but school would be like a horseback, you know, a 2-day horseback ride away.
Yeah, you have to go to school, but you need to camp and, you know, watch out for the wolves.
Yeah.
Because,
And when there's 6 feet of snow, you know, there's cattle to wrangle. School.
Things to do.
Yeah. So, after the Civil War and Reconstruction, there were all these compulsory educational laws on the books. But after the Civil War, Booker T. Washington made a very powerful statement. He said, in effect, there was an entire race trying to get to school. So we've got compulsory education laws. We've got all now of the freed black Americans who want to get an education. So schools are being packed full of little bodies. Parents are sending them. People want to be in school. So we have buildings and we have laws. And school is becoming a thing, but it's basically a lowercase t. They would have a superintendent to oversee an entire state. They would have some idea of how to fund it, but not really. So in 1925, a group of nuns took school to the Supreme Court. And basically what had happened is that laws were passed that said children need to go to public education. And these nuns in Oregon said that that's not fair. If you force all kids to go to public education, we're going to go out of business.
You're muscling out on the Catholic Church's turf.
Exactly.
Can't have that.
So they took him to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that parents could choose where the child goes to school. So you can't force kids to go to public school. They have to have access to private schools.
They have to go to a school.
Yes, or parochial schools. They just have to go to school. So this was in the 1920s. So we had Jefferson laid the seeds. Man started to create the foundation for the system. And now we've got compulsory education. We've got it's the 1920s. And now we're heading into the Depression.
Yes.
And the Depression, what kind of emerged is that children were competing for jobs with their parents.
Can't have that.
Can't have that. So two things sort of happened simultaneously. We had child labor laws, and compulsory school laws went from being just dead letter laws, meaning there's a law but no real reinforcement, to being reinforced. So we had a whole bunch of stuff come together in the 1930s. Child labor laws, compulsory education law, and now social pressure. Because there was a desire for immigrants to become part of the community. Assimilate.
Integrate,
yes. So immigrants wanted to become more American, and to do that, you had to learn the social norms, which are now being transmitted through schools. So all of these things were happening.
So resistance is futile.
It was. It really was. Public education.
Is the Borg.
Yes, sort of. So before, school was something that you might do. Now it became something that you wanted to do. So by the 1930s, we had the child labor laws were full in effect. So in some cases, you could be a 7-year-old who in August was working in a factory, but in October was going to school. So,
which is probably better for you.
Probably better. So we now have the schools, we have the system, and now we're starting to turn into what one might call a bureaucracy. As we head into the 1930s, 1940s, it became unusual for children not to be in school. So before, it was expected to go to school, but if you didn't, it was no big deal. Now, if a child wasn't in school, it became an issue. Truant officers were now full-time things. School had attendance officers. And school became a thing. This is what you did.
It's the real deal now.
Yeah. This is the same time, the 1940s and 1950s, where the phenomenon of the American teenager emerged. Because before this, like 100 years before, you could be 14 and getting married. But in the 1940s, 1950s, if you were 14, you were now a teenager. And they started to open more high schools, so kids went beyond just an 8th grade education. They started to open a lot more kindergartens. Kindergartners have been around for a long period of time, but now it became more expected that you would send a 5-year-old to school. So all of this is starting to happen. And so school is now a thing with a capital T. And around, yeah, so around 1943, there were a lot of lawsuits around what can be compelled in schools. So we've now accepted by the 40s that children will go to school. We will provide a compulsory education to all children, which will transmit our social values and patriotism. We will, there's a lot. When we do our episode on textbooks, we'll get into the whole thing about the religion and Catholic schools and stuff, but we'll save that for another time. But now there are questions like, how many days does a child have to stand for the pledge? Can they sit down? Just how much can we compel kids to do in school? So in 1972, there was a case called Wisconsin versus Yoder. And it's pretty remarkable because it was a lawsuit filed by the Amish. And the Amish said, we have the right to not educate our child past 8th grade. We have the right, the religious right, to pull our children out of school. And the Supreme Court said, yep, you're right. And so Yoder is the foundation for homeschooling, or children who do alternative schooling or unschooling. So by time You, My Great Love, Paul, arrived on the scene in 1975, everything was in place.
Everything was in place for me to go to school in 1975.
Yes. In 1975, there was a poll. 90% of Americans supported compulsory education. It was a thing. You had no choice. You were going.
I had no choice. Yeah. I was going.
You were definitely going to go. So there were buildings, there were teachers, there were the resources, there were tax dollars. There was a transportation system to get you there. There was social pressure. And in fact, the 1970s is when a term started to emerge for people who didn't finish high school.
Dropouts?
Yeah. Which is so funny to think about. You wouldn't have had a dropout in 1852.
You'd had to drop in.
Yeah, exactly. So it's so fascinating to think that compulsory education started as a way to see to children's eternal souls. It shifted into American patriotism. Then it became as a way to integrate immigrants into American society. And then it just became something that you did. So now we're trying to figure out, what does it mean to have compulsory education and continue the conversation of how much we compel kids and what they need to be compelled to do. And if you're curious, because I know you're dying of curiosity.
I'm dying.
The actual law that said you had to go to school when you were six was EL 3204, Title 4, Article 65, Part 1.
See, that is way not as cool as
the old diffusion of knowledge.
Satan law.
Exactly. Now, your mom couldn't get you home for another year. You didn't have to go to school until you were six.
Yeah, she wasn't doing that.
No.
Because everybody else went at five.
Exactly. So you went at five.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kindergarten was not a thing. You went to school and you were five. And when I was doing the research for this, kind of figuring out, tracking the theme of compulsory education, I came across a really interesting quote that said, "In our society, that we provide common public schooling is inherently a compromise. We must therefore strive continually to find a creative balance between local and central direction, between diversity and standards, between liberty and equality."
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
That was pretty cool.
Are you ready for your pop quiz? Okay.
As ready as I'll ever be.
All right, so.
Am I filling in one of those bubble sheets?
No.
Or? Okay,
this is good. A quick little oral. This is a quick little. Well, it's a one-word answer, too.
20 questions, 30
no,
questions.
Just one.
Just one? Oh.
So I'm going to read you a quote.
7. 42.
No.
9.
And you have to tell me what century you think the quote was said in. The 18th, 19th, or 20th century.
Okay, this should be easy.
All right. So here's the quote. "The annual exams and rankings of school angered so many teachers and principals that in blank, the central office held several day-long meetings to allow dissidents to let off steam."
Well, see, that could have been said last week, but the language leads me to believe 19th century.
1868.
19th century.
Yeah, the quote comes from when Boston instituted mandatory standardized testing in schools in 1868.
They've been doing standardized testing that long?
Oh, they've been doing standardized testing since China.
That's probably a whole other podcast.
It's like China though. In the, 2000 BCE. But yes, it is another podcast. A great way to plug an upcoming podcast. So we'll be doing future podcasts on textbooks, on exams and tests, and we got a whole bunch of fun stuff. So please visit us on our website at, again, www.edhistory101. Feel free to drop us a line if there's a topic you're interested in. And until next time, class dismissed.
Bye.